It's nice to be together for study of Bhagavad Gita. And each time that we come together, I begin by sharing teachings from Yogacharya O'Brien that she shared in the past. And then I share a few comments and we have time for group reflection. So let's begin with a short grounding prayer. We acknowledge the infinite indwelling Lord of Love. The one who shines in and through and as all of existence. We offer our pranams, our respect and gratitude to the teachers in this lineage of Kriya Yoga who have brought forth their wisdom to share with us about the teachings from the Bhagavad Gita. Mavatar Babaji Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar Paramahansa Yogananda, Roy Eugene Davis, and our beloved Umaji Yogacharya O'Brien. And we acknowledge our own soul nature and open ourselves to have our innate wisdom revealed, that these teachings be transformative for ourselves and for our world. Om, peace, peace, peace. Today's the day we come to the beautiful conclusion of chapter two, the treatise that is on steadfast wisdom. And we can take a moment now and just reflect on what we have learned in chapter two, beginning with the highest teachings of Jnana Yoga, wisdom yoga, that one reality is beyond and within. It is the source and substance of all life. And that reality is what we are. We are that. But until spiritual awakening, we're not aware of that truth. We believe that we are the body and mind who has a soul. We might think that we're spiritual beings, but we're primarily identified with the body and the mind. And then upon hearing the teachings about our true nature, we're reminded of what is real, and we yearn to realize that. So we embark on this path of self and God realization or remembrance, and we begin to study, to contemplate, to meditate, and to engage in spiritual practice to purify the body and mind so that clarity can prevail. This chapter, chapter two of the Gita, is rich with deep teachings, and in and of itself, it is really complete. It could answer our deepest questions. Yogacharya said that she remembered coming to the spiritual path, that one of her greatest yearnings was that she wanted to know. She said, "How will I know that truth? How will I know that truth? Not only true in terms of the truth of my being and what the real reality of God is, but how will I know how to discern right action? How will I know for myself without having to ask somebody outside of me? How will I know how to act? What is the right choice for me? And we learn in this chapter that we all have that capacity to live by the highest truth and to live in such a way that we're clear and not confused. But the clarity that we need in order to access higher wisdom has to come through buddhi, our faculty of discernment. Buddhi needs to be clear in order for that sort of clarity to prevail. So one of the questions that can come is something like this. Well, since we are spiritual beings and we have the apparatus that we need, we are that divine consciousness, divine self. Why is it that we don't have access to the wisdom that we need 24/7? Why do we get confused? Why do we not know? And the answer that we find in this chapter is that the access that we need depends on how clear the mental field is, how clear our mind is, how receptive we are to inner guidance. And specifically, it depends on the clarity of our faculty of discernment or buddhi, because it's buddhi's function to discern and to guide. And that discernment can be either clear or clouded, because buddhi, in a sense, stands between sense mind in one direction and our essential self in the other direction. It can gather or offer guidance from either direction. As students of Kriya Yoga, we learn about these two directions for our attention and awareness to flow when we study Patanjali's Yoga Sutra. In the first chapter of the Yoga Sutras, we learn that awareness can flow back to our essence of being, or awareness can flow out and become identified with the objects of the senses. We may be established in self-awareness, or we can be identified with modifications in the mental field. In chapter 2 of the Gita, we learn that identification with sensory input occurs through the ego function of the mind. Our ego or false self creates a relationship with sensory experience through attraction and aversion, and by then imposing ownership or doership. I like this, I am this, I did this, I thought that, I think this, it's mine, I want this, I don't want that, and so forth. When ego operates unchecked, that I, me, mine is like a computer program running in the background. And the faculty of discernment can fail to notice it and fall under its spell. Then our guidance system, instead of being a soul guidance system, is an ego-based guidance system. And that's where we're not clear. We think we're being reasonable, but our reason is flawed because it's coming from ego masquerading as the wise self. It's colored by ignorance, which will naturally be self-centered because it's set up by the false self. What I want, what I think, what I see, what I know. It's all colored by that self-centeredness. And we know that is a pathway to sorrow. Ultimately, selfishness always goes there. So how can we change this? How can our wisdom become clear, stable and steadfast. And the second chapter of the Gita puts forth a twofold approach to clarifying the mental field and allowing the inner light to shine forth. First, and you know this, through contemplation and meditation, the inward flow of attention and awareness increases. The mental field is clarified, and we experience the truth of our being. We experience it through that inner awareness, through that divine connection, through conscious contact with our higher power, our divine true self. That direct insight and experience clarifies the mental field and removes the veil of ignorance in which we mistake ourselves for something else. And then the second method is through discernment and the discipline of restraining sense attraction and aversion, seeing it for what it is. This is the way that we dismantle the props of the ego. Through watching where we have attraction and aversion without desire being fueled. That is the key. By attraction and aversion, and then solidified through attachment. This is the way that ego can build its house of a false self. Those are the building materials of ego. Attraction and aversion and then attachment. That's how the false self is propped up. When we pull back attraction and aversion and we don't allow attachment to occur, then there's nothing to prop up the ego's I, me, mine. There's no solidity to a separate self who has this or does that. There's only the radiant divine self that is shining through. Many verses in the latter part of chapter 2 have instructed the seeker to give up desire. And when we look at that on the surface, it seems undesirable to give up desire. How do we live if we're going to give up desire? It sounds unattractive, like not much fun, and at the very least, impossible to give up desire. It's helpful to look deeply and understand what the Gita is telling us, that it is our attachment to desire that is the problem. Our attachment is the problem. The ego that colludes with sense mind gathers sense experiences as personal desire and then runs off with our ability to reason and see clearly. And that's the problem. Desire is natural, but clinging to it is detrimental to our mental health, our physical health and well-being, and to the health and well-being of the planet itself. Verse 67 says, when the mind runs after the wandering senses, then it carries away one's understanding as the wind carries away a ship on the waters. And 68, chapter 2 says, therefore, O Arjuna, the wisdom of one whose senses are withdrawn from the objects of the senses, that wisdom stands firm. So it's removing that stickiness of attachment. We know what it is to have our better sense of things thrown off course, carried away like a ship tossed by the wind. We know what that's like. And now when we study this, we know how to avoid it. We know what causes it. We know how to avoid it. We learn how to have an anchor instead of being blown about by circumstances, by attachments, by aversions. We know how to turn our attention to the self, to awareness of our essence of being, and to detach awareness from objects of the senses. Here's the formula. Don't brood on them. Don't ruminate on them. Don't invite them in. Don't foster them or adopt them as your own. Notice. Let go of attachment and aversion and stay open to a higher guidance. There's a daily inspiration from Yogacharya O'Brien that says, without turning to God, detachment from sense objects is a barren desert. With God, the desert blooms. And this teaching isn't about being unfeeling, like moving through the world with some sort of dryness. It's about the fullness of being anchored in God and seeing how life will bloom with all of its beautiful manifestations when life comes to meet you. Grace comes to meet you when you're not trying to grasp for yourself from that ego level. The renunciation that's recommended by Lord Krishna is not advice to disengage from life. In fact, it's an invitation. It's a prescription for how to be truly alive, to not narrow your life, to not set yourself up for sorrow, to not lose yourself, to not lose conscious contact with your happiness and your wisdom and your peace by letting sense distraction lead you astray. Chapter 2 in the Gita concludes with four beautiful verses that are about being anchored in the fullness of divine self. Starting with verse 69, which on first read might leave you wondering. And this translation by Radhakrishnan says, what is night for all beings is the time of waking for the disciplined soul. And what is the time of waking for all beings is night for the sage who sees, or the sage of vision. So this is paradoxical, isn't it? What does this mean? Why would night be a time of waking and day be a time of darkness? This verse is about one who is really awake. Most of us are familiar with the teaching that those who are not yet spiritually awake are sleepwalking through the world. Before spiritual awakening, we think we're awake, but we're caught up in the mind with the drives of the ego. It's as if we're living in a dream, not conscious. The awakened ones see that the unawakened live, in a sense, a bright world of duality. Those who are in that bright world of duality have their attention captured by experiences and things that are attractive to the senses. They're moving through the world unaware of the reality of God, of the unity of all life, They think it's about me and you, this and that. They don't see. They're blind to the unity. They're in the brightness of the day of duality. They don't see the oneness of the reality of God being present. And they are unaware of their own essential nature as one with all. Well, the sages, in this world of the sages, in a sense, it is like the dark stillness of night in which everything is quiet and peaceful and enveloped in oneness. There's no sense of duality, no boundaries in the darkness of the night. It's that deep sleep state where the senses are quiet. Except here, the sage is awake with the senses quiet. What the unawakened believe to be real, the sage knows to be unreal, meaning changeable or mutable. And what the unawakened believe to be a source of happiness or security, all in the light of the day in the world, the sage knows to be a source of sorrow. It's a vision of contrasting the awakened life and the unawakened life. It's night and day. We know that for those who are not spiritually awake, the awareness of God is like darkness because they can't see the reality of that presence. It's the same world for the awakened and the unawakened, but it's a vastly different experience, like night and day. So think about what you already know about this. And if you're listening to this, you're already on the spiritual path. Perhaps it's familiar to you about how you lived. What motivated you before you found the spiritual path? What do you see now that you could not see before, walking around the world in the light of day? Your eyes were open, but you could not see. And what motivates you now? Where do you find happiness, solace, security? How has that changed? You can really step into this mysterious teaching about that contrast. You can really step into this mysterious teaching about that contrast. It doesn't take long on the spiritual path to begin seeing that distinction about where we were, where we are now. So we ask ourselves, how does one who is anchored in the fullness of the self live? How do they live? And verse 70 says, as rivers flow into the ocean, but cannot make the vast ocean overflow, so flow the streams of the sense world into the sea of peace that is the sage. But this is not so with the desire of desires. So think about yourself being in the world of experience. When we're in the world, in the way that is led by ego drives, and, you know, what we want, what we don't want, and we want what we want. When we're in that world, whatever occurs can disturb us. It disturbs our peace. But when we're anchored in the self, we see life unfolding and happening all around us. We don't have that reactivity. We have an ability to respond instead of react. It's the winning formula. When we abide in the fullness of our being, sense encounters, worries, interactions do not move us to act. When we abide in the fullness of our being, what happens with the senses, sense encounters, worries, and interactions do not move us to act. In other words, we're not stimulated through attraction and aversion. Our action is not instigated from that place. We're moving by a higher wisdom, by a higher awareness. We're imperturbable. We're steadfast in wisdom. And this is great encouragement for the spiritual practice. It's a promise. We begin to experience what it is to be anchored in awareness of the divine self while in the world and be free from that reactive nature that causes us to go off course. And verse 71 says, "The person attains peace who, abandoning all desires, moves about without longing, without a sense of mineness and egoism. It's mine. I'm the doer. I'm the owner. I want." This is a description of someone who has attained that fullness, that peace of spirit, of self and God realization, and moves through the world as Jivan Mukta, liberated while in the world, a free soul, not even concerned about basic desires, free from all longing. Imagine what it would be like to live in the world, to move through the world with freedom, complete freedom from desire. And of course, we can't just decide to have this experience. This is an unfoldment. It's a higher state of consciousness. It's a beautiful promise of what that could look like in such a free state. But then we have to ask what is needed. When a sage lives in this state of freedom, whatever is needed to sustain life comes to that sage. The person is moving freely through the world, and what is needed is provided by life itself. Along the way on our spiritual journey, we can begin to capture encouraging glimpses of that. We start to have a cooperative relationship with the infinite. We see how that works. When the ego gets out of the way, life will provide. Just like Jesus taught in the Sermon on the Mount, don't be anxious about your life. He said, "Why are you anxious about what you're going to wear, what you're going to eat, all of that? Consider the lilies of the field and how they grow. They don't toil nor spin. Even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these." So he's pointing to this innate urge of life to support itself. This is underlying that Jivan Mukta state, free while in the world, having a cooperative relationship with the infinite, in which what is needed comes to you. You can be free of desire, of longing, of wanting. Those we're studying and practicing, just begin to envision what that would be like and ask, what will it require? The last verse of chapter 2, verse 72 says, "This is the divine state, Arjuna. Having attained this, one is not deluded. Fixed in that state, even at the hour of death, one reaches the bliss of God." So wrapping up this chapter, Lord Krishna refers to the awakened state that one never loses this awakening from ignorance, from avidya, from the idea that we're separate from source, from wrong knowledge about what we are. Once that illumination occurs, the false identification of the self with the body-mind complex drops away and one never forgets. And there's a hopeful promise in this verse as well. You know, you might wonder, well, what if you're on the path for a long time and you've not been able to remove all your desires, your attachments, and you're clinging to ego sense as much as you've wanted to? And this verse says it can still happen for you even at the 11th hour, even at the doorway, at the time of death, it can happen. But regarding this teaching about the 11th hour, Yogacharya O'Brien's guru, Roy Eugene Davis, would say, why wait? That's cutting it too close. Besides, he would say, besides, the awakened life is so much more enjoyable. So may we be encouraged to live the awakened life now, taking these gems from the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita and learning how to free ourselves from attachment to desire through spotting attraction and aversion and freeing ourselves from that. And we can do it. This is what Lord Krishna tells us in this beautiful chapter. So next time we'll turn to chapter 3 and explore more deeply what has been laid out. Everything has been given in chapter 2. But Arjuna is like all of us. He takes it all in and says, I've got it. And then he says, oh, wait a minute. Now, how exactly does that work? And that's where we're going to go in chapter 3 next time. Om. I love this part about the night and the day. And I always love reading the translations from Lahiri Mahashaya, his Gita commentary. So I titled this little response for myself, The Way of the Sage. Seeing in the dark, waking in the light. And I'm mostly going to be sharing commentary from Lahiri Mahashaya. He wrote about verse 69, chapter 2, what is night to the worldly is day to the yogi. What is day to the worldly is night to the yogi. And this verse, of course, describes the transformation that occurs when we turn within. And while most people, including us sometimes, are caught up in outward pursuits unconsciously, caught up by social media, constant news, you know, whatever's going on in our families, material ambition, those on the spiritual path, the practitioner of meditation is awake to this inner light that shines in silence. And in this age of distraction and digital overload, spiritual awakening might appear like sleep to the world. You know, others might think we're just not with it because we're not caught up. We can participate in the digital world, in the political world, in the world of our families, and we must. But it's like Uma said, it's like night and day, how we show up. It's the same world. It's the same existence. Lahiri's comments on this verse, he wrote, when the yogi closes the eyes and interiorizes the mind, then he awakens in the dark of the night of ordinary consciousness. This is night to worldly people, but it is the dawning of light to the yogi. And I found this quote from Umaji in Living the Eternal Way. She wrote, "Through yoga practice, the inner light begins to dawn. What was night becomes day, and we are no longer lost in darkness." And in verse 70, Lahiri Mahashaya wrote it this way. He said, "One into whom all desires flow like rivers into the ocean, which remains full yet unmoved, this one attains peace, not the one who clings to desire." And Roy wrote about this one, "When you're anchored in your true nature, you are not disturbed by changing conditions. You are free." And that's pretty much the cliff notes for chapter two, right? I'll leave it to Roy to give us that. When we are anchored in our essence of being, we are not disturbed by changing conditions, and we are free. Lahiri wrote, "When ego and attachment are renounced through constant kriya practice," of course, this is not constant kriya pranayam, it's the wholeness of the practice. "When ego and attachment are renounced through constant kriya practice, peace arises. This is not the peace of idleness, but of samadhi." So I have more notes to share, but I want to just stop and say something about this before I get to my, you know, I like three or four points always to end with. I'm certain that we have all had, in our own way, an experience that has come from a transformative experience that has come from the depth of our meditation, where then after meditating, we walk into the world and we feel that we know what we're moving spontaneously. We know what is the next right thing to do without thinking about it or trying to figure it out. Even if we've just had this like for 10 minutes after meditation one time, it's a taste. And so that tells us that this is possible. That taste tells us, oh my goodness, yes, this is possible. It is possible for us to remain anchored in awareness of our true essence. When we do that, I was thinking about that, this, you know, it's sort of like we have all these practices. Thank goodness. We have all these practices. So when we're anchored in constant awareness of who and what we are and our essence of being, and we're just being that, we're not thinking about it. It's not like, oh yeah, I'm anchored. I know what I am. Boom. No, we're just being. It's complete freedom. We're moving, literally moving in the world, taking steps, not even knowing where we are going. We are just being guided each step. And things are occurring around us. We can see other people's upset, the turmoil, the joy, all of it. We can see it. We can appreciate it, but we are not hit by it. We are not pulled into it. We're witnessing it. You know what I'm talking about, with your eyes open. When we are experiencing it in this state, it's sort of like We are magnetized. I like to think of, like there's a, you can take a magnet, put something in between it and hold it in space. It's like we have a magnet below us and above us, and we're just held in that place when our consciousness is clear in that way. But that doesn't, for most of us, that doesn't last forever yet. And so we have all these practices. When we aren't totally tuned in to these magnets above and below us, let's just call it that way, because we have to use duality to explain it. When we're not connected up in that way and we start wobbling, thank goodness we have all these practices that help prop us into that upright position. Are you following me? So we do our practices. Because then we can step in faith into the next right thing to do. When we're in that sort of awakened state, conscious, not like, vata deranged, but conscious in the world, just moving, we know that everything is okay, no matter what's happening around us. We can see the drama of life without getting caught up in it. But when we're not in that completely clear state where we feel carried in that strong way, and we feel that we're getting pulled into the drama of life, and it could be great, happy drama, or it could be drastic, sad drama, whatever it is, everything in between, then we call on our practices. And Uma made it so clear for us. Attachment and aversion, I mean, attraction and aversion that become attachment, that is the prop of the ego. Those are the things we're undoing. That's what we're looking out for. So not, oh no, I have a desire. Oh no, I desire some of Ishwari's divine cooking, whatever it is, some of Kashi's cute cooking with the little stars, whatever. That desire is fine, but being attached to it, like I'm not going to live if I don't get that sweet potato that's been cut out with a star mold that looks exactly the way I think it should look. You know what I'm saying? Watch out for that. Not the attraction, it's natural to have attraction that propels us from within, but not that pulls us externally. So, oh my gosh, here we are in this world that we live in. Here are my four things to end chapter two. How do we live these teachings in this sometimes fast-paced, distracted world? Number one, awaken daily in silence. You know this. Even 20 minutes of deep stillness each morning helps us to step into the day as an awakened yogi. Most of us spend at least an hour, and on Thursdays, 2+ hours. But even 20 minutes. So, number one. Number two, observe desires with clarity. Desires will arise. Notice them, but don't identify with them. Let them flow. Appreciate them. What did Uma say? Don't invite them in for tea. Number three, release the illusion of I. I'm such a great yogi. Look at the seva I'm doing in the world. I. That's just helping the ego to be stronger. Release the illusion of I. Serve without clinging. act from our higher self, not ego. And then number four, persevere in practice. Practice until this awakened awareness becomes natural. It can and it will. If that is your strongest desire, your desireless desire, as Yogananda would say, your desireless desire to fully awaken spiritually in this lifetime, it is possible to live as a Jivan Mukta. We have examples of that. Lahiri is quoted as saying, without Kriya, understanding of the Gita is incomplete. Its truth is in experience. When you enter the stillness, then you know. Om. Well, we made it through chapter two. It's been a very practical chapter for us. I look forward to your comments. Hi, Mina.
Hi, everyone. Thank you, Sundari, for the beautiful teachings. As I was contemplating desire, what came to me is what I think is the flip side of desire, anxiety. And thank you for bringing up that quote from Jesus, because anxiety is desire from the way I see it is a desire in another form where there are desired outcomes. I am anxious for this to happen. And when it doesn't happen, then it causes pain and suffering. So I just wanted to raise that.
Yeah, thank you for reframing that. It's pretty much what Uma is saying, right? That from desire, attachment to that desire is what rocks our world. And I don't think she meant rocks our world in that way. And anxiety comes from that attachment to things needing to be a certain way at a certain time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's important to let go of. Thank you for reframing it. Hi, Subhadra.
Good morning. Thank you so much, Sundari. I just wanted to share, I made a connection with last week, because today you said whatever occurs disturbs our peace unless we are anchored in the self. So I've been doing that practice of trying to notice when my peace is disturbed, and then the breathing that we did, the inhale and exhale. So if I notice something has disturbed my peace, then I just stop. And I've been practicing pausing and doing the inhale, inhaling, I am anchored in the self, exhaling, peace flows through me. And so then I made that connection, and that was really helpful.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. Those are some of, you know, we have the attraction, aversion, attachment that prop the ego, but then we have our practices that help dismantle the ego and, in a sense, prop the soul. I see Wayne B.
I really liked what you said about those intervals after meditation where you're ready to go out in the world and apply that oneness consciousness. And I've experienced that. And what I think is important is to accept that I'm on the right track and just expand on those brief intervals so that they're happening more frequently and for longer periods of time. And I think that when it does happen now, it's soon after my morning meditation session, something comes up, and I just feel like I have the opportunity to apply my practice, and then they kind of disappear a little bit, and I probably don't look for them as automatically as I do right after the meditation. So I think being aware of that whole idea of a taste is enough to keep me motivated to look for more of them and expand on it.
Yes,
Thank
thank
you.
you. Thank you for saying that, Wayne. And part of Uma's teaching this morning was about if we could just make this happen, we would. If we could just say, yes, I decided, boom, it's happening, we
Right.
would. But that's not how it works. However, the way that it works is, remember, was it last week, the teaching from Buddha, drop by drop?
Yep.
Drop by bo drop, brimful becomes the awakened one. So there's that, but there is also, it's a state of samadhi that burns the seeds of samskaras. And that can occur in at one time, and poof, you're awake. But it also can occur a little, like you're saying, a little, a little, a little. But there's also an in-between where it can occur and you begin to awaken and have much more insight, and that stays. It's like a bigger taste. It's like, I had some of Ishwari's divine dessert one time, but then after I had it four times, I knew I really wanted it. Sorry, Ishwari. I'm just making up examples. No pressure. So thank you for reflecting that back. And I think we all have that. Lilia
Thank you.
wrote, how can we avoid having detachment become cynicism? Like, you don't want to become cynical once you're detached. Is that what you mean? And the answer is to understand that it's all one. That we're not separate. We're not separate from it. We're not, there's not an us and a them. Okay, I hope that is supportive. Susan and then Ishwari.
Hi.
Hi, Susan.
Hi. Thank you so much. It's so good to be with you all. And thank you so much for the teachings today, Acharya Sundari. I've been reflecting over the question of where I find happiness, solstice, or solace and security in my life. And I find it in connection. And my meditation practice, it's that gift. That is the gift that I receive from my meditation practice, is this connection. And I feel like when I am moving out into the world after I meditate, that I'm able to connect with others in a different way. In particular with my family members, the people that I live with on a daily basis. By responding rather than reacting. So just really reiterating what you taught today and how I experienced that in my life. I really appreciate that. It's and the days that I don't meditate, it's a different type of day for
Yeah.
sure.
That was such a beautiful way to say the difference between living in the dark and the light, right? We're outside, we're in the day. In the light, brightness of the brightness, but inside, not so bright.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you for
So I
that.
just wanted to share my reflection on that. And I really appreciate the teachings today. So thank you.
Ishwari?
Thank you. I just, my heart is filled with gratitude. for the teaching today. It was so clear, and thank you, Acharya, for your, I think your transmission of that, it's very powerful. I was contemplating before Gita today, I was trying to figure out the difference between ego and personality and buddhi,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I kind of wanted to know, well, when am I in buddhi and when am I in ego, and kind of to discern what, I think it's a feeling state of what the differences are. And I also didn't even know what personality is, because you have to have one. You know, you can't just be Teflon. You know, when you go to the yogi path, I kind of felt like Teflon, you know, like aloof, or maybe even cynical, like Lilia mm-hmm. said, you know, that if I didn't have, you know, share someone's enthusiasm, I sometimes pretended to be enthusiastic, because it was like, it wasn't that I wasn't enthusiastic. It's just that I think detachment and what is the other word? Detachment and it starts with R. Anyway.
Repulsion?
No, not repulsion. Renouncing, you know.
Oh, yeah, renouncing. Yeah.
So it's, you know, so when I was younger, you know, in the practice, it was like, wow, these people are really like not really expressive or something, you know? And anyway, I think I got into a different set of ideas right here. What the idea was that I was grateful for was that you answered my question of, you know, yoga, ego, personality, and buddhi. And I feel like my takeaway right now, and I will love, actually, I'm going to listen to this again and maybe take some notes that time. But I think it's, you know, I need to discern, like, where am I standing? Where am I standing? Standing in God, standing in me over you. Ego is like me over you. Personality is kind of like me. And then buddhi is more like we. That's all. But I'm just a little surprised at how direct this teaching was with where I was contemplating. And I'm grateful. Thank you. That's all.
Yeah, that's what attunement does. You know, when we're attuned to the same guru or teacher, we're attuned to one another, because mm-hmm. we're all in that same wave. And so that's how it works. And I think you addressed Lilia's question a little bit there about Teflon. It helped me understand her question a little bit more. And, you know, it's... we do have personalities, and it's part of the joy of being alive. The key as a yogi is to relate soul to soul, to recognize and let your personality express, but to relate as a soul to a soul, to not relate to a personality, but to relate to a soul. So that's some of the dance in it, and understanding the difference between personality, ego, and buddhi, and how that all works, of course, is part of Samkhya philosophy. And maybe I'll add another short course and go more directly into this way it connects up with these teachings of the Gita. Maybe I'll add a little session to the Samkhya course that I put together. But when you see it, for me, when I see it mapped out visually, here's how they line up. And I can see buddhi is actually a prism that can be getting light from our soul or It can be getting information only from the senses and reflecting that back. It's always going to have one or the other, but which is it identifying with? Which is it most aware of? And so that's when we are able to relate soul to soul instead of stopping the light of Buddhi and saying, no, I'm only going to interact at personality level. But it's tricky. It's tricky for everyone coming onto the path to not just think I'm supposed to be Teflon. Right? It's a tricky thing. And then eventually you just let your free self go. It's too tiring to be Teflon.
I think I changed Teflon to silicone since it's more environmental.
Okay. Very smart. Very smart.
The course that you were talking about, I think that I'd like to review that. And especially now that we're doing five elements this month too. So
yeah, there's a meditation in there on the elements and on the senses. Mm-hmm. And, but that was an introductory course. So it did not go into this as practical as you and Lilia and others are asking and sharing about your experience. So there's more room for that.
Yeah, very good. Thank you.
Saraswati likes that idea too. She can help me. Okay, it's nice to see you all. It's always nice to hear from you. I know you like seeing one another. Thank you for your patience. I don't know. Nope, still doesn't work. Thank you for your patience. And Mukti, I'll send you a note about editing. Thank you for that. Have a most blessed day. If you are in the area and you can get to the center, come and see Yogananda Murti when you can. Hello, Sachin. Hello, Sarika. And hopefully the rest of you got to see Yogananda online, those who live at a distance. I don't know if Bhavani, was the whole thing recorded? Can people watch last Sunday's satsang and see the Yogananda? Maybe she's not really there. Well, we had it online. So Susan, I don't know if you got to see that. But if you go to this past Sunday's satsang recording on the website and go down and look at the... there's a link that says Sunday Attunement Satsang. You click on that. There's a list of each Sunday. That recording probably has the consecration of Yogananda Murti on it. It was very sweet. Okay, much love to you all. It's a joy to be in this study group with you, and I'll see you next time. Mukti, can you stay on for a moment? Oh, now my mouse is working perfectly.